Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Sharif Bassioni of DePaul University, Brian Endless of Loyola University, and conservative commentator Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago on the city's fashionable Near North Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to send us an email or comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this program, you can do so on our website, beyondthebeltway.com. And tonight, we're going to be talking about the world focus at the moment, which is on Egypt. It has been since 1981. Hosni Mubarak has been an international household name when he followed in the footsteps following the assassination of Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Egypt is one of the strongest allies of the United States. Since 1979, they get about $2 billion a year in support. They are right behind Israel in the recipient of U.S. foreign aid. And yet that country and that president are perhaps on the ropes. You've been following the news over the last 48 hours. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, made all the rounds of all the programs this evening, or this morning, rather, including CNN's State of the Union with Candy Crowley. Last week, you may recall, Secretary Clinton said that she thought the situation in Egypt and the government was stable. She might want that word back. She did reaffirm the United States' commitment to Egypt as a country. What she did not say, however, is that the Obama administration would continue to support the Egyptian president.
We're not advocating any specific outcome. We are advocating that the government, the representatives of the civil society, the political opposition and activists begin a dialogue to chart a course. Egypt is a large, complex, very important country. I don't think the Egyptian people want to see what is a very clear effort to obtain political and economic rights turn into any kind of new form of oppression or suppression or violence or letting loose criminal elements. That's not what they're in the streets protesting for.
Joining us now, we have a variety of guests and great guests this evening. Sharif Bassioni is here. He is a distinguished research professor of law emeritus at DePaul University, and also was emeritus with the law school's International Human Rights Law Institute. His credibility and credentials are impeccable. He was born in Cairo, raised in Cairo, left there in 1962. He was imprisoned in Egypt at one point, came to the United States, started teaching at DePaul in 1964, became a citizen of the United States in 1965, and again, one of the country's leading experts on the subject of Egypt, and we are delighted that you're with us for the next 2 hours this evening.
Thank you, Bruce.
Sharif, my question to you is, as you look at the pictures and as you've spoken to your friends and you're getting all kinds of feedback from all over the world, from the people that you know, many of your good friends still reside there, what is the current situation on the streets in Cairo?
Well, the current situation in terms of a factual description is you do have a number of demonstrators who continue to remain on the streets, and that's for a number of reasons. One is there's no public transportation. Two, they're poor people. They don't have any cars. They can't leave. So they're basically stuck there. And if a curfew is enforced to have them leave, many of them won't be able to come back the next day. There are also a large number of prisoners who have found their way out of prisons. Close to 5,000 common criminals have escaped from prisons. Now, to the best of my knowledge, in the last 50 years, there hasn't been a single person who escaped from an Egyptian prison. Suddenly, 5,000 escape. They are the ones who are on the street doing all of the looting and destruction.
In the analysis that we've heard on international television over the last 48 hours, it is that the internal police forces are not held in high esteem by the people. but the military is, and all kinds of pictures of getting, you know, rides on tanks and everything else. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, why? What is the difference in the respect that the people have for those two institutions?
Very fair assessment. The police is held in very low esteem. Number of reasons. The police is in contact with the public. They don't deliver justice. They don't deliver the service of public security. They are corrupt. They have served the regime. They have always been in the service of the oligarchy of the 200 families or so who control the country. They are known to be very repressive. I mean, the estimated number of political prisoners in Egypt per year, in other words, the rotation, is no less than 15,000. Torture has been rampant for years. They are totally discredited. The army has been out of the street, out of domestic matters, have always been respected, held in high esteem. I hope that continues, but that means that the army can't be used to fire against the people.
Brian Endless also joins us. He is with Loyola University. $2 billion a year, every year, since 1979. As an American taxpayer, what are we getting for our money, and why does it have to take this long to get the attention of Mubarak, and obviously a guy who's losing control of his country?
First, thank you.
Couldn't we have used that money better?
Thank you for having me on first, Bruce. And I think we could have used it better, but I also think we've been getting a lot for that money.
Like
it,
what?
It is effectively the deal that came out of the Camp David Accords when Israel and Egypt made peace. The unofficial deal was that Israel and Egypt would both get fairly equivalent funding into the foreseeable future in exchange for keeping peace between them. So it was a first salvo by the United States to try to assist the Middle East. And frankly, it set us up with an Arab country, Egypt, that was very friendly, that was going to be one of the primary countries that would be able to help us on the Arab side, and set up a situation where our close ally Israel wasn't going to have to worry about that back door in the Sinai. The Egyptians have also, frankly, been very helpful toward Israel on the Palestinian situation. That's probably part of what the Arab street, if we can want to call them that, in Egypt doesn't like very much. But the leadership, Mubarak, and the upper levels of the Egyptian military have certainly been more on Israel's side than the Palestinians many times.
Chris Roebling also joins us. Chris, in the wake of the war on terrorism, what role has Egypt played, and how much of that $2 billion has really been parlayed to assist us in that region of the world to fight the war against al-Qaeda and terrorism?
Well, I'm not a professor.
I know that.
I'm sitting next to some pretty heavy intellectual firepower here, so I'm gonna declaim that right at the start. You know, in a way, the $2 billion, the mountain of U.S. aid that has gone to Egypt since that spring day in 1979 hasn't done the immediate work that we may want to, but it has created a framework for everything else that has happened. And as much as we think about the Middle East, we can barely imagine it without the framework of the Egypt-Israeli accords that are referred to as the Camp David Accords.
Our telephone number is 1-800-723-8289. We got firepower here tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly with your calls. They're already coming in. From Spokane, Washington to Allentown, Pennsylvania, you are listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Professor Bassioni, you wanted to make a comment about that $2 billion.
Yes, actually, it averages about $2 billion every year. 800,000 goes to the civilian sector. 1.3 goes to the military sector. Now, what's interesting is figures games. The 1.3 that goes to the military sectors, for the most part, is military equipment that is sold by the Defense Department. For the most part, it's either surplus equipment or equipment the Defense Department doesn't want, and it charges it to the budget at the same cost that right. it got it, right. and then it gets a credit for it yeah. to do other things with it. So there's a little bit of gamesmanship
well,
on
that's
the
good
figure.
To know.
But Israel's got some of the same security assistance arrangements.
But but Israel is smarter and knows the game and says, okay, if you're going to charge me X number of dollars on this item, I want something
but
else.
But here's my point. If what you're saying is that it's going through the military.
Yes.
If the military has been the primary a recipient of all this U.S. largesse over the years, you said in the first segment that the military is fairly popular with the people. So I'm sensing that there's not a seething anti-American feeling there. Certainly, we haven't seen the traditional anti-American signs or even anti-Israeli signs, at least so far. And I've almost been glued to the TV for the last 48 hours.
That's not the issue. I mean, the issue right now is bread on the table. It's justice. I mean, these are the common issues. I mean, I'm almost tempted to say they're somewhat similar with a lot of due relativity to the issues the American people feel today.
I want to throw this out. The young people of Egypt are facing a hopeless situation, and that is a crying shame. And the economy has not grown sufficiently under Mubarak. And so there is an economic opportunity. So that young men who in the society that one has in Egypt have to achieve certain monetary or cultural or sort of indicia of success before they take a wife have no chance to – it's not a dowry. It's like a male dowry system.
Average age is 24.
And these men are walking around wondering, what have I to look forward to? And then they're communing with their uncles and their grandparents who are members of the Islamic Brotherhood, some of whom are loyal nationalists, but there are, you know, gradations, and they can get radicalized. I also want to just very quickly say Ben Bernanke is a big part of why we are seeing this, because through quantitative easing, he's promoted inflation. And if you are going to print dollars, inflate the currency, increase prices, Egypt, which is the largest importer of wheat in the region that you've got there, is going to suffer. And so people are suffering in Egypt today. People are dying in Egypt because of what Ben Bernanke did at the Fed.
I think it's not just the youth, although that is absolutely a key part of it. We're also dealing with the middle class here. And in most societies like Egypt, when you see a middle class, you think that they're elites. But in Egypt, we have middle class non-elites. So this is a group that has ostracized the youth. We have about 60 to 65% of people under the age of 30 in Egypt. I just looked it up today. The world average is 52% under 30. So Egypt is one of those countries that's much higher than that. They have all the problems the two of you have been mentioning. And then we have a middle class that has effectively no political power whatsoever, and that affects their economic opportunities too. So we're kind of seeing just the big picture whirlwind all coming together at once, and those are the groups we're seeing protest.
Sharif?
Both of you are absolutely right. Add one more factor, which is not really frosting over the cake, but is also a very crucial factor, in that a small oligarchy of about 200 families owns 90%, exploits openly, notoriously, and the corruption is so rampant, and it seems like all the institutions of government work for them.
And can I say, this is not news to those who study it, and it's certainly not news to the United States. George Bush was trying to
address... It's a common denominator of wherever we get in trouble. Isn't this the same? We run into the same problem. We pour money into a country with someone with a dictator, although, you know, Biden said he wasn't a dictator, but he certainly sounds like a dictator, walks like a dictator. And we keep propping these guys up, and we always get trapped.
Well, George Bush was trying to...
And yet we're calling out for freedom.
I think...
Except when they need the call, and we wishy-washy.
Maybe in a later segment we can talk more about the politics. We're just less than a week away from a State of the Union in which world affairs received almost no mention. The Middle East received almost no mention. Egypt received no mention. Tunisia, which is already aflame, received no mention. We are in a detached, in my opinion, as the conservative Republican, we have an administration that is profoundly detached from events in the world. And to the extent it has engaged, it's been on the wrong side of freedom. That's not to say it should adopt everything of Bush, but it has adopted a lot of Bush. It's adopted 70% of Bush. I wish they had adopted this 30%.
What was Bush doing? I mean, Bush was there for 8 years.
Of the whole idea of Bush's democracy exportation was to get ahead of these issues in the region. And the whole idea of Iraq was to provide something of a beacon. Now, I'm not saying that any of this is – you can't do in Iraq what
all right,
has
so
to
the,
be done.
All right, so my question to you, Brian – do you think, again, any of this rhetoric that Chris is referring to that came out of Bush's comments and even speeches that Condoleezza Rice made when she was Secretary of State, which were certainly encouraging of a thirst for democracy, is any of that at the core or anywhere near the core of these people that are in the streets now? Were they inspired by those words?
I don't think so at all. We're looking at a 60-plus year trend of the United States having a policy of stability and security on one side versus freedom on the other. And we stick with stability and security almost every time. The only time that we look at freedom is when the people rise up internally or when there's some kind of revolution. Iraq is an excellent example. I don't think that had anything to do with democracy, no matter how much the words were there. One of my favorite quotes from George Bush is, "You can't have democracy at the point of a gun. You can't have an invasion that leads to democracy." He was talking about Lebanon at the time, shortly before we invaded Iraq in 2003, but I think he was right.
The first thing that Mubarak did is he appointed a vice president, his vice president. First time in 30 years he appointed a vice president, Mr. Suleiman, who was the head of intelligence, is the head of intelligence. Who is this guy, and why did Mubarak think that by appointing this guy, closely associated with him, he somehow would keep the crowds quiet? Sharif.
Well, Omar Suleiman is a career officer in the Army. He's an infantry officer. He served as the commander of the Presidential Guard. He was deputy director of military intelligence and for the last 20 or so years, director of general intelligence with the rank of minister, cabinet. In the last few years, he was given the portfolio of dealing with Israel, Palestine, the United States. He is a very level-headed person, very honest, known as a man of integrity, a very conservative man, and essentially a military person.
Respected by the middle class,
Respected by the middle class, and I would say respected generally because general intelligence does not deal with domestic affairs, so that the only people who do not like him are the people on the Muslim Brotherhood side or on the far left side who feel that he's been too pro-U.S. and pro-Israel.
Or, we should also say, or who are very young, not educated, and they're just part of the crowd.
Not particularly. I think because for some particular reason, directors of intelligence in Egypt are seldom in the media. I mean, having his picture is quite a rare event. So, you know, he's
so it's not like his counterpart in Pakistan who would be viewed as a bad guy.
No, never, never. Not at all.
So that's very important.
Not at all.
And again, Egyptian intelligence, this is a very important point, Egyptian intelligence and Mr. Suleiman in this case is not your typical bad guy, rogue.
This is not Savak.
Absolutely
right.
Nothing.
This is
they
not
have
not Savak at the
no,
time.
This is not a king of torture.
No. They have nothing.
Feared by the people.
No torture, no internal affairs.
Very important.
No domestic jurisdiction.
Right. Suleiman is on the military side. The Interior Ministry and the police are the side that the people fear. They're the places that people look to as the torturers. In Suleiman's case, he became the consummate military insider in 1995. He was chief of intelligence at the time. Mubarak was going on a trip to Ethiopia, and Suleiman was the person who suggested you should really bring your armored car with on this trip. That was the assassination attempt against Mubarak in 1995, which he survived with Suleiman sitting next to him because of that armored car. That made him the insider. Mm. At the
I'll
same,
say that would be
pretty good.
He would certainly be my insider and my choice for vice president.
Absolutely. At the same time, he was not in the line of succession. And this is where he had a minor falling out with Mubarak. I don't think we can think of it as a big one. Mubarak really wanted his son Gamal as his successor. The military really wanted Suleiman as the successor. And that had been an internal battle that had been brewing for about the past 3 years, which was just literally settled this weekend when Mubarak named Suleiman as the vice president and effectively set his son completely out of the picture. That was certainly one of the things the protesters were.
But we have got Chris, the reason that this is so significant is that we have a region of vast significance, great cultural heritage, a 5,000-year-old civilization. And you've got, you know, a society from Morocco to Indonesia. And in many of these Muslim-dominated countries, you have ruling elites that have squandered all opportunity to the exclusion of the regular, the hoi polloi, the regular folks, the vox populi. And Brian and I are going to agree to disagree about Bush foreign policy and the reasons and causes and sources thereof. But I will tell you that we as a country, we now have Barack Obama. He's got to get on top of spreading the benefits of freedom and liberty and democracy, or else we're going to see a lot of folks overrun.
1-800-723-8029. I promise we do have callers on the line. We will engage you when we roll on from Chicago on this important night, coast to coast and border to border. Tonight, taking America's political pulse on Egypt, its future, and our role in it. From Sacramento, California to Columbia, South Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM Satellite Radio. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Sharif Bassioni is here. He is a distinguished research professor of law emeritus at DePaul University College of Law, also emeritus of the law school's International Human Rights Law Institute. In 1999, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in the field of international criminal justice and for his contribution to the creation of the International Criminal Court. Again, a native of Cairo, came to the United States in 1962, and you were imprisoned in Egypt. How long were you imprisoned and by whom?
Well, I spent 7 months in house arrest under the Nasser regime. I had served in the army in the 56th war and received the Medal of Honor. I was in the outside the city of Port Said during the war, and I was wounded. I had received a temporary appointment in the office of the president, at which point I realized that torture was going on, and I started voicing my opposition to it and yelling and screaming. And I also had a few Jewish friends who had been ordered to leave the country, and I stood up for them and went to bat for them. So they couldn't put me in a common prison because I had received the Medal of Honor. I was put in house arrest for 7 months inside a house. The shutters were nailed. No electricity, no telephone, no radio, guards at the door, with the threat of being taken at any time and being tortured or killed. And so physically, I was not tortured, but I know the meaning of psychological torture.
Left Egypt in 1962, came to the United States in 1964, became a citizen where he started to work at DePaul University, and in 1965 became a citizen of the United States, author of 32 books, editor of 47 others, hundreds of articles. Also joining us this evening is Brian Endless. He is with Loyola University. He has specialized in the United Nations Security Council, in particular actions towards Iraq and other areas in the Middle East. His focus also is primarily on the politics and conflict in Rwanda, but also he brings a great interest to the subject that we are discussing this evening. And also joining us this evening is Chris Roebling, who is a political talk show host, sits in for me occasionally, but most importantly, he's a public affairs consultant for Jane M. Thompson and Associates in the Chicagoland area and a longtime political operative in the city. Let's go to Barrington, Illinois, where Al is listening to us on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Thank you for bringing on the distinguished Sharif Bassioni, who I hope he helped Baradei, lead Egypt to freedom. But the reason why I'm calling is because I think we really need to dig deeper on Omar Suleiman. I really think that he is a lot worse than people know. Jane Mayer, respected author of New York Times, in the latest New Yorker, and she's the author of The Dark Side, she wrote that the go-to person for renditions in Egypt was none other than Omar Suleiman. And Richard Neville wrote that Omar Suleiman actually personally tortured the Australian citizen Mamdouh, I forgot his full name, Habib, Mamdouh Habib. And so I really think that Omar Suleiman should be denounced by our administration, and I think we really need to be on the right side of history now. I really respect Sheikh Bastioni very much for his work on torture, but I really would urge him to look a little deeper.
All right, let's let him respond, and then the others want to respond as well.
Well, he was the head of intelligence. Yes, he had to be the one who approved the renditions and the torture. There's no doubt about it. The intelligence in Egypt has a long history of having engaged in torture, especially under the Nasser regime. So I don't think he's an angel. He's very much of a military man. I don't see him as a promoter or sponsor of democracy. He is, as all military men, going to be a staunch nationalist, but very much of a law and order man.
This is Chris Roebling. We must not get hung up on personalities. Now, that's a big statement in a place like Egypt, where Hosni Mubarak assumed the presidency after the assassination of Anwar Sadat, and he's been there for 30 years. I mean, there were people at the time who thought he might be there for 6 months or a year or two, and look how he consolidated power. But one thing I agree with Secretary Clinton today is we have to encourage processes. You know, she was somewhat incoherent in referring to political opposition must be heard from. The political opposition they're the ones who are still in prison right now. We've got to encourage the evolution of civil society in this 5,000-year-old culture about which most of us know so very little.
But do you do that from the streets? Do you do it with Facebook? Do you do it with Twitter? Do you keep the international heat lamp on? Because I don't know what other way. Hasn't been working.
We're not going to be able to do it with security assistance, food aid, and some diplomatic, footsie under the table about is there going to be a tunnel into the Gaza Strip or not?
But my question, which I asked before, and I'll let you tackle this, Brian, and that is, I asked the question before the break. Mubarak thought that by naming Suleiman, he would quiet the crowds down. Thought it. Now, was he thinking that because he's 82 years old and out of touch, or is somebody advising him to think this way? Because clearly, it may not be playing out well.
I'm not sure he actually thought that, Bruce, and that's something that there has been a lot of suggestion. Mubarak is out of touch. That's extremely clear. Okay. I believe what he was likely thinking at that point in time was he had to do something to keep the military on his side. And Suleiman was the way to keep the military on his side.
Could Suleiman be the advice of the United States? This is speculation, though.
Very slight possibility. He is certainly favored by the United States. He's a person that both the U.S. and Israel, Sharif was mentioning earlier, have had close dealings with. He is very well respected, both diplomatically and militarily on those two sides. I don't know that we would have advised it. We certainly would not object to it.
Our caller mentioned Al Baradei. There are cameras there. He's usually where the cameras are.
They're giving him the Bassiouni treatment. He's under house arrest.
He said he wasn't.
He said he wasn't.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Al Baradei again. He's been dominating the news.
Well, let's get back to what Brian and you said. Mm-hmm. Omar Suleiman is not really the choice of the army establishment. The Minister of Defense, Al-Tantawi, very much dislikes Omar Suleiman.
Sure.
And is very opposed to him, was opposed to him. And in fact, he only agreed to him with the specific understanding that military affairs will be outside his purview. And that's why the President Mubarak appointed a prime minister who is also a military person, who is the former chief of staff of the Air Force, whom Tantawi, the Minister of Defense, approved of. So what you see is not something designed to placate the people. It's something designed to shore up the regime, to ensure its continuity. And that's fundamental.
At what point will the troops fire back? Or would that be would that just be the absolute death knell of Mubarak if he were to do that? International reaction.
First of all, the troops are not going to fire at random. There is a strategy that's being worked out. I believe I can understand the contours of the strategy. And the contours of the strategy started when over 5,000 prisoners, common criminals, have been released in the street. And when secret police have been going through the streets at night firing weapons to create greater fear. 2-3 more days and nights of looting is going to cause the government to say, enough of the looting. We need to restore peace and order. At which point they come out with a very simple formula. You want to demonstrate peacefully, do it during the day, at night, go home. The demonstrators will not be able to go home because they know they won't be able to come back. At which point the army goes in, and so the army now has the fig leaf cover of going in, not against the people, but in order to protect the country. That becomes the basic justification. Once that's done and the country is under control, you will see the new prime minister organize a new cabinet, remove some of the old corrupt visible figures, and move towards some reforms and improvements. Next step, it stays on until November. November is when Mubarak's term ends. He says, I'm not running again. In the meantime, there are 10 months to see whether Omar Suleiman or Shafiq, the prime minister, is better equipped to assume the presidency. New elections are had. Changes to the constitution are going to take place to allow more political parties and opposition, and there are going to be new elections, and everybody is going to say, oh, there is now democracy in Egypt.
Holy
cow.
We're done.
We've got it. Folks, we're going to leave you a little bit early because we've just right in that last Sharif. 3 minutes, Sharif Bassioli has
I'll tell you what, I think
we can get out here early.
I'll bet you a cup of coffee. Write this down. And when that
materializes, we're going to save this tape.
Flag the tape.
CNN hasn't been giving that scenario.
We'll put this tape on YouTube.
But the
music is playing. You cannot talk. You always talk when the music starts.
Sorry.
By the way, when we come back, this is something for those who are listening around the country who really feel strongly about the Second Amendment. There is no Second Amendment in Egypt. And all those people in the streets, they've got bats, they got knives, they got machetes, they got rocks. You can't have guns in Egypt if you're an Egyptian. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Before we continue with the call, Sharif Bassioli before the break gave us a succinct, about a three-minute capsule of what is likely to happen in this situation that most people in the world, at least politically astute people, are observing at this particular moment. But you wanted to add a postscript to that as to you've got a timetable that you want to share with the audience.
Yes, I think the timetable is basically the army has to be in control of the streets by Thursday. If not, Friday is going to be a day in which we're going to see, after the Friday prayers throughout all of Egypt, massive, massive demonstrations. And we're likely to see no less than 2 million people in the streets. If that happens, then it's going to be very difficult for the military and the new plan, if you will, to succeed. Then things get out of hand. So they have until Thursday to control the situation and therefore to prevent this Friday sort of popular uprising. But the problem is, if the army...
So right now when you say a popular uprising, what we're watching now, sort of the weekend, we're watching the weekend version. The weekend version isn't the popular. It's not really popular yet. Insofar as the massive numbers.
The cameras are focused in Cairo. Let's look at it factually. What you had is a popular revolutionary uprising, which we described earlier, in which the people erupted in the streets. Suddenly, we see a new dimension coming to it, a new group of people taking advantage, engaging in looting and theft. Then we see an increase in the looting and theft. people working into vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods, fires being shot at night, the fires presumably coming from people from the secret police. The sense of instability is increasing. And now the question is, if the instability increases, the insecurity increases, it becomes a justification for the army to open fire. Now, this is a delicate balance. It's a little bit like what happened to us here in 67. You know, how do you fire two shots and control the situation, or do you suddenly realize that the two shots killed two people and brought in more violence
right.
and the escalation?
That's the 68 convention,
exactly.
Right.
I think Sharif's scenario that you just outlined is one of the worst-case scenarios. Probably the only case that's worse is Mubarak decides he just wants to sit it out and hang on and doesn't even allow November elections to go forward and really cracks down. I think there are other options, though, the main one surrounding the military, because the scenario that we just laid out assumes that the military is going to support Mubarak and that there aren't people in the military who either see that, A, it's time for Mubarak to go because that's the best way to keep stability in the country and to
but
keep
Brian,
themselves
they
in
do,
power.
They do. But you know, you have to remember the military are very honor-bound people.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't shame your military colleague, your military leader. His term of office is in November. What they're saying is, okay, let's keep him there, sideline him, no embarrassment. He ends his office, goes home.
In the meantime, what is the Muslim Brotherhood doing? What are they doing right now?
Well, Muslim Brotherhood, first of all, you have to realize is it represents less than 20% of the population in Egypt. It is not a very strong nor viable political force.
But are they in the streets now?
They're not in the streets.
They're plotting?
Because we don't know that. Until now, the Muslim Brotherhood has sought to gain the favors of the military regime in order to get to power.
Right.
But this last election, the government kicked them out.
Yeah.
So now they're seeing how the winds are turning. And it may very well be that they'll do nothing and collaborate with Omar Suleiman and General Shafiq.
Well, and I want to, this is not in any way, I have no standing to disagree, but I certainly agree with everything Sharif has said. I just want to keep our eye on the longer term. And even now, just to think in the longer term of 5 to 15 or 10 to 25 years, because there will be transition in the countries of the Middle East, and there will be a new day. And I think the question for us is, how bloody will the transition be? Does it have to be? We hope not. And what will the transition is to what? Okay, because we have millions upon millions of people and so many other reasons to be concerned about these developments.
Well, again, we thought the Shah was a bad guy. In retrospect, was he as bad as
Shah was? I thought the Shah was a guy who was doing the most he could with Persia as he found it.
Okay,
the Shah was our bad guy.
Well,
he was a bad guy who was sending a lot of his opponents to very tony U.S. colleges.
Susan's got a question from Chicago. Go ahead, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Question about Syria and neighboring Syria.
Yeah.
Why in the world did President Obama, in January, restore diplomatic relations after 5 years, send a U.S. ambassador? Were reforms demanded? Syria is a dictatorship. Assad jails his opponents.
Right.
Did Hillary Clinton ask for more freedom for the people of Syria?
We'll let Brian answer that one. Brian Endless.
I'm not sure we'll know until people write their autobiographies, but a good guess on this is that Obama and Hillary Clinton were very hopeful that they were going to get a deal with Syria and Israel over the Golan Heights. And the restoration of discussions of the opening of relationships with Syria again may have had a lot to do with that, and that certainly hasn't materialized so far.
All right. On that note, we are through with hour number one, but stay right where you are. This group will be back in the next hour. Brian Endless from Loyola University has been with us. Sharif Bassioni from DePaul University. Chris Roebling, one of our frequent guests on this program, also been with us. We'll keep the phone lines open at 1-800-723-8029. We've got a great panel here for you this evening, so it's an opportunity. You've been watching the news for the last 48 hours, I'm sure. Good opportunity to get some insight into what's happening. In the next hour, we're also going to hear from another gentleman who's going to join us. He is Yasser Tabara, and he is with CARE, which is an organization of Arab Americans in the United States interested in Islamic relations. Back shortly from Chicago. Don't go away. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Sharif Bassioni of DePaul University, Brian Endless of Loyola University, Republican commentator Chris Roebling, and Yasser Tabara, who is with the Council of American Islamic Relations. He joins our panel after an hour of discussion with our other guests. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. There have been an awful lot of people standing by waiting to talk, so we're going to bring some callers in right now, and then we'll continue our discussion. Let's go to Bryant, who's listening to us in Redding, California, on KQMS. Nice to hear from Northern California.
Yes, well, thank you. My major concern is, you know, I understand where Barack Obama is going to a certain extent, but it seems to me that if he doesn't watch what's going on, he may end up with a repeat of the Iran hostage situation.
Chris Roebling, do you worry about that?
Well, I think there are very significant differences between Egypt in 2011 and Iran in 1979. But I think that acknowledging all of those many manifold differences, one may also see some similarities. And the similarity is, in my opinion, and I've disclosed my bias, but, you know, there has been a process of disengagement, in my opinion. There's been a process of withdrawal from the region, a lack of understanding. And the question, part of the question about Tehran in 1979, although I think events quickly spun well beyond the control of the United States, was the real nature of the positive relationship between Iran and the United States. And I think the nature of the positive relationship between and the overt anti-Americanism, okay, that was part of Khomeini's return from Paris. Here, we've talked about food, we've talked about economic opportunity, we've talked about a calcification of society, we've talked about a lack of political. And this is almost more like Russia in the late 19th century.
So the question,
and the fact that there were no political options for the officers who came back from France after liquidating Napoleon's army, if not Napoleon.
The question I would ask then is, thus far, and you know, only for the most people who've tuned into this in the last 48 hours, have we underplayed any undercurrent of anti-American feelings that might not yet have demonstrated themselves? Yasser Tabara, your comment on that.
First of all, thank you for having me on the show. I think that allow me to reframe the discussion just a little bit, because I feel that there's something that is glaringly missing from this conversation, and that is that what's happening right now on the ground in Egypt does not really need pundits or analysts to grasp. It's a raw uprising of basically a large segment of the Egyptian society. That is non-ideological, that is non-religious, that does not have any of these underpinnings, and that is extremely important to emphasize.
And
in my opinion, I think that if anything, the American administration's attitude towards all of this has not has glossed over that, and has not understood that fact, and have, if anything, overemphasized this. Muslim Brotherhood element, or this Islamic, or this ideological kind of component to this revolution, this people's revolution, and thereby bringing these kind of irrelevant facts into the equation.
No, but here's one question I ask, insofar as just the images. Obviously, the images now we're watching on television. Television is far more expansive than it was in 1979. But the early images of 1979 were not only U.S. State Department people being taken hostage. It was the constant burning of the American flag, or the replaying of that video over and over again. Thus far in this situation, the American people that are used to seeing the American flag burned in demonstrations around the world, we haven't seen that yet. So my question to you is there something that's out there? Has it just not been used? I mean, we've heard the story about the tear gas canisters that are being, shot, are made in the USA and, stuff like that. But, I mean, I don't sense a strong anti-American feeling here, whereas I did in Iran.
I absolutely agree. In fact, this uprising is, and it's been covered by international media, it's been covered by the American media, and I've been somewhat disappointed in the framing of the issues by most of the American media, specifically CNN and others, because I've been watching other media channels and the way that they're covering it and the interactions with the
people. How's Al Jazeera playing it?
Basically interviewing people on the street. We haven't seen, I've been glued to the TV. I've been constantly making these contrasts between Al Jazeera and CNN, for example, and I haven't seen any expression of anti-Americanism. This is about people asking for accountability to their government. This is about the youth, the jobless youth, basically asking for jobs, asking food for to be put on the table.
Yeah, I think that
Sharif Bassioni,
in the first hour, we've all agreed that this is not about foreign policy. This is not about America. This is not about Israel. This is purely domestic. Now, the most important difference, to answer your questioner from Northern California, in 1979 and prior to that, the U.S. was heavily involved in the internal affairs of Iran. The U.S. in this case is not and has not been involved in the internal affairs of Egypt. It provided support for the Sadat and the Mubarak regime, but it was not involved domestically. So the U.S. is not at issue here. To introduce the U.S. or Israel now would be to, in a sense, deviate the discourse from the focus in which it should have.
Brian Endless.
Two things. You mentioned Al Jazeera. I've loved their coverage so far. Mm-hmm. They've got a great site where they're doing live coverage on the web. You can find it. We think of Al Jazeera as being very biased, but I think Yasser's absolutely right. There's been very little difference. Al Jazeera just does some more street interviews, but you can see very similar things on CNN right now. The other thing is I completely agree with Yasser on the framing issue. The press has framed this for us as a dictatorship, and then the other two choices are people's democracy or an Islamic fundamentalist government. I don't think either of those, people's democracy or Islamic fundamentalist government, are likely. Sharif mentioned that the Muslim Brotherhood's only 20%. On the democracy side, though, I'm going to go back to something Chris said before the break. There are no democratic institutions in place for a democracy to take hold. It's going to be a long process before Egypt can get to democracy if they're moving in that direction.
This begs the question, Bruce. I've got to say,
go ahead.
Why has Hosni Mubarak failed to modernize Egypt? Why was he was given the mantle to bring Egypt into the 20th century at the end of the 20th? Or to,
because the country was working for the 200 families.
Well,
the country was working for the 200 families.
All right.
And so after 30 years, right, do you have to pick up one of the largest literacy rate in the world?
That's
embarrassing.
Last year, the University of Chicago Press published more books than were published in all of Egypt. More books from one publisher in the United States than published in all of Egypt. And what was the missing element? I mean, we understand the isolation of Tsar Nicholas, and we understand what happened at the end of the 19th century and the reaction to there's the music.
The music is playing. Music plays every time you talk. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Yasser Tabara is with us. And during the break, we were talking about missed opportunity, that Mubarak has missed an opportunity for 30 years to bring up his country, to educate his country, to make it more competitive, has a lot of great natural resources, cultural resources, and obviously so focused on perpetuating his own power that he's forgotten about the people, and he's now paying a price for that, and it may ultimately pay the ultimate price. But you were saying that he is not the only one that's missed this opportunity in the Middle East.
Yeah, that's correct. I think this is definitely a pattern in the Arab world, but we have to take a step back and look at the history. I mean, I think that we have to understand that the Middle East, most of the Arab world, is dealing with a pretty heavy post-colonial legacy that has lasted for decades. And I think that also another thing that should not be missed is the fact that most of these dictatorships have been, if not installed, have been empowered, have been perpetuated by foreign governments, by foreign interests, and that basically translated into the lack of development of the people under these dictatorships, and that's exactly the case in Egypt and many of its Arab neighbors.
Do you agree with that, Chris?
Well, I think absolutely. This is the point that I was I made a version of this point. I'm not going to appropriate Yasser's point, but I made a version of this point at the beginning. I mean, there will be change. There will be transformation. And I think the question that we have to ask ourselves, looking at this full life vivid example, which happens, I agree, not to be of the Islamist character and certainly not of the 79 and Tehran character, is what are we doing as a country? What are we doing as a culture? What are we doing as a society to assist these transitions to a place where there will be a role of democratic institutions and civil society? I think, unfortunately, we now look and we see there are a lot of places where this hasn't happened. I have the Bush administration and Iraq, and I'm sure there's disagreement at this table. But somehow or another, people have got to get connected with their political lives. And in Egypt, that has not happened.
Well, how do they get connected to their political lives if they haven't been taught the basics of education? And I guess my question, not only in Egypt, if this is a systemic problem in the whole region, where is the thirst for knowledge and the sharing of that knowledge with the masses? Is there anywhere in the Middle East where they not only respect knowledge, but they want the masses to be educated?
I think, Bruce, thirst for knowledge is a human condition. I think everyone has it. The connection of knowledge to the masses is something that's more difficult. Turkey might be a good example here, and I actually want to lay it out as a counter to what Sharif said earlier. I think that he laid out the status quo, worst-case scenario, of Mubarak stays in power, and then we go to another military-led government. I believe another possibility, I'll probably lay it out as the best case scenario, is we could get some movement forward from the military. But I think it would have to be led by them with some civilian input, whether it's Al-Baradei or someone else that drives that forward. The question is, does the military want to open up? And take the example of a Turkey or a Pakistan, where you're looking at more of a Praetorian-style government, where the military are still the keepers of security, the keepers of stability, but they allow institutions to move forward and they push those institutions.
You mentioned Al-Baradei, and again, we had a caller early on that asked about that, and I was asking you that question. I don't think I got an answer from that, Sharif. Al-Baradei, it's a name that some people know, International Atomic Energy Commission, the guy that looked for weapons of mass destruction all over the world. Found him someplace and didn't find him other places. He's now emerging, at least as a guy who's being interviewed on the street. He's the most famous person on the street that's being interviewed. Them. Does he have any credibility at all, or is he just a media hog at the moment?
Well, he has a lot of credibility in the West. He has a lot of media attention in the West. He does not have a political party. He does not belong to a political party. When he returned to Egypt, when he retired from his position, the opposition, the secular opposition parties, and nobody knows how much they represent, maybe at best 10% of the popular vote if we had a popular election, but we don't know because we've never had a popular election. But they were the ones who embraced him. However, he did not connect, if I can use that term, with the Egyptian people, much as Gamal Mubarak, Mubarak's son, never connected with the people. You know, in order to connect with the people, you have to have something that is an intangible. You know, going to public schools, serving in the army, you know, having walked the streets, having stood in line, you know, these people who are educated Western style and who decide to come back and want to play the role of saviors may be relevant to an intellectual class. They're not relevant to the rank and file.
Well, here's the question I would ask, and I wanted to spend some time talking about about Twitter, about Facebook, their role, the internet. You know, shut down the internet was one of the first things that Mubarak wanted to do. The role of new media in this revolution, and if Egypt is looking for its political savior at the moment, and they don't know who it is, there's no name that's come out yet, is there someone that's going to come out of that new generation, young activist in the street, put the pressure on? Can that be, as it has happened in other parts of the world, including the United States with Ronald Reagan, can there be a pop culture figure who emerges as a political leader because of their charisma? Chris Roebling. We may not know who it is.
Yeah.
But well, you got a tool here now that nobody's had this tool before.
I want to draw on the history of Egypt and the history of the region. And I want to say Egypt has been a center of Islamic thought, of Jewish thought, of Christian thought. Egypt was Christian long before it was Muslim. The mountain of learning in Egypt is like Everest, okay? Compared to any other society in the world. And I'm saying this out of respect and out of sort of admiration for the 5,000 years, because if there's any society in which new media can take hold, or this is a society in which the interchange of ideas may not be what we consider to be appropriate, but this is a society with incredible intellectual background to take new media and to use it.
Yes, sir.
In fact, Bruce, new media has taken hold. I would like to actually tie this up with your point about education. The status of the Egyptian middle class, if you will, which this uprising is all about. This is about the middle class Egyptian society, and that's who's on the streets right now. That's who's asking for government accountability. That's who's asking for jobs. These are the youth that are very well connected, that are technically savvy.
And you think that's the core of what's out there?
Absolutely.
So it isn't.
Absolutely. I'm actually watching okay. for example, watching Al Jazeera in English or other media. Channels, you have constantly people that are being interviewed that actually speak English, for example, okay. On the street.
Okay, so just to put a few groups together, you have the middle class, articulate, somewhat, you know, trained, educated in some way. You have the lower classes, uneducated but frustrated because there's no future, and then you have obviously the power class,
the oligarchy,
and then you have the people that get most of the media, as they always do. You got the hooligans, the thugs,
absolutely, and that's
the prisoners. The web is open, free, and
everybody
and democratic, small d democratic. It is a social utility, and it says we're in the 21st century. That whereas in an uprising, when you had an uprising in the ghettos in Poland, the Nazis turned off all of the power. In the 21st century, they turn off Twitter.
Okay. So, to the Second Amendment people listening tonight, you want to protect your guns? Protect your internet. Pay your internet bill.
I'm not going to disagree with that.
Okay, go ahead, Yasser.
Well, I mean, they may shut down the internet, but there are a lot of Egyptian youth out there that were very, very creative in finding proxies, and they have been.
I know that
you know, something similar is kind of brewing in other countries where The internet has been tightly controlled, but the governments cannot seem to go around, you know, these creative solutions by the youth. But again, I wanted to go back to the education point that you made. I think that Mubarak and other Arab dictators, I mean, the lack of development wasn't necessarily focused on raising the literacy rate or any of these types of statistics, because the Arab world in general is relatively high in literacy rate. It's the political awareness and it's political savviness, and that's what's been very, very tightly controlled.
Aren't they above average tech savvy?
Well, what this new generation basically has been open to new satellite, you know, news channels, the new media. We've had about 15 years of Al Jazeera, for example, that has been broadcast all over the Arab world, has broken every barrier out there in terms of taboo, you know, subjects, in terms of politics in the Arab world, and I think we're reaping the fruits of that open kind of revolution, if you
but
will.
But with the I'm going to ask the question, then we're going to pause for the break. Let everybody think about it. With this younger generation that has access to the internet and has got their Twitter and their Facebook accounts, they've got their passion. We know that that repression breeds rebellion. We're seeing the rebellion now, and because of the education and the technology that is available to them to spread the revolution, does that make them more or less susceptible to going to a religious answer that we in the United States might fear as radical Islam in any way? Or because radical Islam is perceived to be medieval by some, do they have no chance with that crowd? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Nice to have you with us this evening. Around the table, we've got a full board tonight. Sharif Bassioni is here. He is a distinguished research professor of law emeritus at DePaul University College of Law and president emeritus of the Law School's International Human Rights Institute. In 1999, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in the field of international criminal justice. Also joining us this evening is Brian Endless. He is with Loyola University in Chicago, and he specializes in the UN Security Council, in particular actions towards Iraq and other areas in the Middle East. And by the way, just a quick answer, there is no immediate role for the UN likely in this.
I don't think so, no.
Okay, I didn't think so either. Also joining us is Chris Roebling, a longtime frequent guest on this program with J&M Thompson & Associates. And Yasser Tabara is here. He is was born in the United States, raised in Damascus. He's a Syrian-American, and he is with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He is on their board. He also serves with the Muslim Education and Cultural Center of America and is a practicing attorney, also from DePaul University College of Law. And before the break, I asked a long-winded question. I asked everybody to remember it, because my age isn't at my age. I don't necessarily remember all these questions anymore. But Sharif, you remembered it.
Well, I don't know if I remembered it entirely, but let me address some elements of it. And the first is...
By the way, I can summarize it. The question was, the new media... Does the new media and the people that use the new media, are they likely to be susceptible to a message of what has been described in the United States as radical Islamic belief?
Right. First of all, the present revolution is not motivated by radical Islamic belief. There is no radical or even Islamic dimension to it. It is truly secular and popular. The Egyptian people is a very religious people, so they manifest their individual religiosity, but it has nothing to do with either religious belief or ideology. Politically, the Muslim Brotherhood has elected to stay out of this round. Whether they decide to be part of it in the future is a question of how they calculate the political benefits they can derive from it. For the time being, they're sitting it out. Now, coming back to what Yasser said, a word of caution, I think the mix of who is in the street will vary from city to city. So that in Cairo, you are likely to have more intellectuals, more middle class, more educated people. If you go to Upper Egypt, like in Beni Suef, where there were a lot of uprisings, you're not likely to have that. You have more of a rural society. In Suez and in Port Said, you have much more of a commercial group of people living there, people working in the Suez ports and Port Said. So dock workers, a lot of blue-collar workers. So the
not necessarily Twitter people.
Not Twitter people. The mix of the population is different. Now, getting back to the Twitter, as Chris said, when you deal with ancient civilizations, it's quite surprising how they manage to sort of jump forward and embrace modern technology. So that you see that even in ancient civilizations like Afghanistan, where you see people with long beards and turbans, and they're perfectly capable of tweeting and using their cell phones, including the Taliban's and others. So,
well, Al-Shabaab in Africa has used
exactly
the internet,
in Somalia as well. So this is quite common. But I think the point is, there's a difference between people using it as a means of communication and the means itself being the basis for emerging new leadership, emerging new ideologies capable of creating new leadership.
Brian Ennis of Loyola University.
I completely agree, Sharif, and let me take that a bit farther. We're talking about new media. We're talking about masses of people from different classes rising up in the street. We haven't mentioned a leader. And that's because I think the old media has been right on this point. This has been a leaderless revolution so far. And when you look back at revolutions throughout history, one thing is immensely clear. If the masses happen to rise up without a leader, somebody will take advantage of that at some point in time if they're given an opportunity.
And my question was, is there somewhere in this pop culture world where a leader emerges because they happen to be the popular people amongst the group that can organize, and suddenly, you know, there's going to be a rallying party at some, you know, disco in Cairo, and this guy suddenly is the next president.
It's a possibility. It's more likely that someone who's more established will take control. But we can't say because we haven't seen this particular type
before. We've got to take calls. Tom in Youngstown, Ohio, you've been waiting a long time. WKBN. Go ahead, Ohio.
I'd like to bring the focus back home to the U.S. With the fragile economy we have right now, wouldn't it be in our best interest to start drilling for oil and lifting the restrictions on that, given the fact that, you know, we've seen this in Tunisia, Egypt, I think Yemen, and you know, who knows, it could spread to Saudi Arabia.
Let's let Chris comment on that, and also let's talk a little bit, because we're almost done with the program, and we haven't talked about the role of oil in Egypt and its economic position in that region and the world.
Oil and Egypt, A, it's not a huge producer, but B, it's a big transit point because of the canal, and so you want to be very acutely aware of Egyptian stability relative to the Suez Canal and the amount of oil that's coming through the canal, although Suez Canal oil generally is not going to come to the United States, but it has an effect on the world price. To get to the caller, thank you, caller. Yes, we need to do all of the above energy exploration and exploitation. We must not remain dependent as we are on foreign sources, though we're not particularly dependent on the Gulf.
Anybody else want to comment on that?
I think Chris and I can agree to disagree again on this one. I don't think it's a question of any drilling we can do. Any additions we do are a drop in the bucket, and the price is set by the international market, and there are just so many countries that produce so much more than we do. If it's anything, I would think this would be a call to look at other energy sources.
One story that has gotten quite a bit of publicity and coverage today, and it happened with Afghanistan and also in Iraq as well, and that is in which the crowds, I would describe the hooligan crowd, the hooligan element, which tends to get a lot of the press, what they've done to the museums, the attack on the museums. Is that the type of thing that will cause the average Egyptian on the street to become so outraged that is the pressure that leads Mubarak to bring in the troops to quiet the looting.
It's like a page from Sharif's playbook. I mean, that's just to allow the bad guys out so that they'll trash antiquities. What's more, we've seen in the last 25 years as such a growing and beloved sort of sentiment for their own antiquities. They're trying to reclaim them. We had that happen right here at the Field Museum. Only 3 years ago, there was a presentation, and the Egyptian minister of culture was here. He said, whoa, time out. I recognize this mummy. It's got to go home. And so the Egyptian sensitivity to its own history has increased, and this
So, again, does this, getting back to your scenario that you painted in the first hour, is this something that is allowed to happen?
It's allowed to happen, and it's made to happen.
So we're looking at agent provocateurs.
Yes, but again, this brings us back to the savviness, of, if you will, of the middle class that is part of this uprising in Cairo. I mean, again, I've heard several reports of very responsible young people who basically who've taken the responsibility on their shoulders to protect these types of antiquities and to protect their neighborhoods in the absence of the police.
No, they're the ones that are out there with the badge
of
the clubs.
No, but wait, yes, the point, we of course have to recognize that. But if you think about it, the impact of this type of, call it hooliganism and criminality, serves what purpose? It serves the purpose of justifying the army's intervention and remaining of the military junta.
And what I'm saying is that's not going to happen. I mean, I think I understand exactly that tactic, but I think that the people are not going to fall for it, if you will. I think that.
Yeah, but when you think that about 5,000 ordinary criminals have been released or allowed to escape from prison, that you've got a few agents provocateurs in the police who are driving in the streets of the city at night and firing, discharging revolvers, they're creating it.
Absolutely. And you say the revolvers because you're not supposed to be able to have a gun.
That's correct.
People can't have
You can't
guns.
Have any weapon. You can't have any fire weapon. If you're caught with a fire weapon without a license and they don't give out licenses, it's a life sentence in prison.
There you go. You want tough gun enforcement? You have it in Egypt, folks. Let's go to Mark in Chicago on WLS.
Yes, hi, gentlemen. I've been listening to you all the night, and from what I'm hearing a rather, in my opinion, an overly optimistic picture as to what will happen in Egypt given a change in government. Call it a revolution, call it what you want. The reason I say that, the Muslim Brotherhood, while they appear to be somewhat benevolent, they are the umbrella organization, the springing organization for the likes of Hamas and Hezbollah. And I think that it's very nice that they could sit on the side, watch what goes on in the streets, let it look like the religious right, if you will, is in waiting. But in reality, when all is said and done, there's going to be a void. And to think that Western-style democracy is going to emerge in Egypt, just like it didn't emerge in Iraq, I think it's just nonsense.
All right, I'm going to let everybody respond to that. We do have a break coming up. The music is a play-in, so we'll get everybody an opportunity to respond to that when we roll on. One more segment to go. If you've not called in, lines open, 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse tonight on Egypt and its future. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for being with us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Reminder for those listening on WLS Radio in Chicago, our flagship station, tonight at 10:30 on the television version, Inside Politics. We're running the local political discussion tonight at 10:30. Again, we'll be talking about the big news this past week in that the Illinois Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to Rahm Emanuel to stay on the ballot, and he's taken two steps closer to the fifth floor at City Hall. And again, that'll be coming up at 10:30 tonight on Inside Politics on WYCC and cable television, Comcast, tomorrow and through the rest of the week. Before the break, Brian Endless of Loyola University, you were about to make a point as we continue our discussion on Egypt.
So I think the caller was talking about radical Islam and the potential it was going to take hold. That's something the press in the U.S. has really picked up on. I think that question has been driven by Mubarak and by his actions and by the United States government to set up the Islamic fundamentalist boogeyman effectively and to say this is why the dictatorship was necessary. In fact, though, Egypt is not an Islamicist country. And it's one of the countries that shows the great distinction between the Arab culture and the Islamic religion. Egypt is the home of Pan-Arabism under Nasser. And it was a focus on the culture of being an Arab. Yes, most of the people happen to be Islamic, but that means that they go out to prayer on Friday and that they follow the Islamic religion. Not that it's a central point of their lives. Not that it drives their politics in any significant way. Egypt is immensely proud of being a secular society. So while there is some undercurrent, and we have to think about that, it's simply not likely that that undercurrent is going to be able to take hold with the masses in the way it did in Iran, for instance.
Yes, sir.
I couldn't say it any better than Brian. I mean, I think if you look at what's happening on the ground right now, there's nothing at all to indicate that there's some sort of expression of religious radicalism and taking hold of this very organic movement and uprising. And I think that goes back to the deep lack of understanding of the American administration of what's really taking place over there. And this is reflected through the many statements that have been made over the past few days by Hillary Clinton and President Obama. I mean, for example, at one point she had actually said, and I quote, "We stand with the Egyptian people and their government." She actually used these two words in one sentence when people were on the street basically demonstrating against their government.
This is when she was saying they were stable.
Yes, exactly. That's at the very beginning. That's kind of the delusional state that's unfortunately we're in.
Doesn't watch it, she's going to have the batting average of Joe Biden.
Asking you to put words in Barack Obama's mouth is not fair for anyone that knows who you are.
Really?
Because you're a card-carrying conservative and you think he's a socialist. But my question is this.
But he's a very nice guy.
Put aside your politics. What should the President of the United States, what message should be communicating right now? Chris.
I think the United States of America should be standing for freedom, democracy, and a path thereto. And it has to recognize the realities on the ground in Egypt, or for that matter in Iraq, or for that matter in Iran or Afghanistan. It can't go around and just do this at the point of a gun, but it's got to have a point towards democracy. And I want to say, the Islamic Brotherhood, much of it is like the Kiwanis Club, but some of it is like the Weathermen. I mean, a very small sliver. And you've got to be aware of all. We've got to understand the massive complexity of Egypt.
Agreed on the values of Chris, but the United States should not take solo position. Yeah. It should join France, the UK, Germany, other Europeans, maybe bring in the Russia in it. The United States should not stand alone.
I agree.
The risk of things going wrong are too big. We should not be identified with further failures. We should be part of a different position.
Will they all agree? Will Russia agree with? Do they want the same future for Egypt that we might want?
Bruce, the UK, France, and Germany issued a joint communique, which is much more progressive than what the United States said.
What Joe Biden said.
Very, very close to what Chris said. I mean, it embodies those values.
Does that mean that Chris is a progressive or?
Well, I'm a progressive conservative in the Jack Kemp tradition. As he said, in the Conservative Party, there are those who go to the Kiwanis Club and those who may also go to the extreme. So that's the only commonality between the conservatives and the Muslim Brotherhood, is that you have the whole range of it. Yes.
Brian.
I also think we have a public face and a private face to diplomacy here. Public face, President Obama has to walk a tightrope because we have other allies that he doesn't want to scare. I think he could move further. I think he could say more. Private face, we don't know what the administration is doing. I certainly hope they are pushing Mubarak and the military to move toward phasing Mubarak out in a peaceful way. Including more people.
I would also hope that they're sending the words to the other despots of the world that we support. Go turn your TV on, folks. Watch what's going on, and be on the right side of history.
It's time
to make the switch.
I wish that you would have this message that Brian's saying. I don't think that's the case. I think that on the private side of diplomacy, This administration is extremely careful not to alienate the cozy relationship it had with Mubarak, with King Abdullah, with the King of Saudi Arabia, and so on. And also, I must say, this is not a situation in which the United States should speak, as the American Indian would say, with forked tongue.
We've got to stand by
our values, support our values, make them a reality, make them a policy. These double standards is what has doomed American policy abroad.
Sharif Bassioni has been with us from DePaul University. Brian Endless from Loyola University, thank you very much. Yasser Tabara from the Council on American Islamic Relations, and Chris Roebling. They have all joined us for a wonderful two-hour discussion of world affairs tonight on our program. Thank you very much for being with us. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Radio in Chicago. Tom Veracruz and Jason Sayer and Dan Dorfman all help make the program possible. Again, thanks very much for being with us. Who knows? We may be back to this subject next week. And again, as Sharif said, if you tuned in the program a little bit later, he said the streets have got to be cleared by Thursday night. So we got 4 days of watching wall-to-wall TV to find out what's next. Again, thanks very much for being with us on this special edition of Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.